In 1936, nine young oarsmen from the University of Washington transfixed their fellow Americans and, as one writer later said, wiped the smile off of Hitler's watching face as they beat the German crew to win the gold medal in rowing at the Berlin Olympics. But even before they won the gold, their coaches knew these young men were something special.
The boys who had made it this far were rugged and optimistic in a way that seemed emblematic of their Western roots. They were the genuine article, mostly the products of lumber towns, dairy farms, mining camps, fishing boats, and shipyards. They looked, they walked, and they talked as if they had spent most of their lives out of doors. Despite the hard times and their pinched circumstances, they smiled easily and openly. They extended calloused hands eagerly to strangers. They looked you in the eye, not as a challenge, but as an invitation. They joshed you at the drop of a hat. They looked at impediments and saw opportunities. All that, Bowles knew, added up to a lot of potential in a crew.
In other words, they were rowers, and they were Americans. That's Daniel James Brown reading from his new book, The Boys in the Boat, which is about rowing, but it's also about America at a certain time and place. And Daniel James Brown joins us in the studio. One writer calls this Chariots of Fire with Oars. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. So where to start? How about where did you start? A lot of people knew that the African-American Jesse Owens ticked off Hitler
right.
at those Olympics. I did not know about the Washington State crew.
I did not know either, and I had lived in Seattle for about 20 years when I started this. The story literally walked into my living room one afternoon in the form of a woman named Judy Willman. She said that her father was under hospice care living at her home, and she had been reading one of my earlier books to him, and he wondered if he could meet me. So a few days later, I went down to her house and sat down with him. His name was Joe Rance. And he talked a lot about growing up in the Depression. And then he began to talk about this experience he had had of joining the University of Washington's crew and ultimately of going to Berlin in 1936 and rowing against, among others, a German crew in front of Adolf Hitler and other top Nazis. And as I listened to that story, I was mesmerized by it.
Yeah. Well, we've heard a little bit about who they were. Set the scene, which is also a character, of where they were. Washington State, 1930s, late 20s, so unknown to Easterners that when they finally do begin rowing and come east, people think Seattle is in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, people on the East Coast, in some cases, literally didn't know where Seattle was. Seattle in the late 20s and early 30s was a pretty dark, dismal place, where not much was happening.
And Joe Rance becomes a metaphor for this time. His mother died when he was young. His stepmother didn't like him. She was an aspiring violinist and was living now in poverty with Joe's father, and they just left him.
Yes, right in 1929, in the fall of 1929, Joe came home from school one day and found his whole family packed into a car with the car running, and his father told him that he was taking his new wife and the other kids and leaving, and Joe was not to come. And so for quite some time after that, he had to subsist literally by foraging in the woods for mushrooms and berries and poaching salmon from the Dungeness River.
Well, but that terrible rejection also may have been what fueled him. He gets to the University of Washington. He doesn't dress well, but he's a hard worker, and crew will keep him in school.
Yeah, exactly. Crew ultimately is his salvation. Because he had to depend on himself, he had nobody but himself to depend on. He became very independent, but he had a hard time trusting other people, understandably, after what had happened to him. And when he first joined the crew, he had trouble fitting in with the other boys in the boat. He had a hard time just opening himself up to other people or trusting other people.
You can't have that in a skull.
No. Crew is all about cooperation. I mean, it is. Of all the sports that are out there, crew more than any other depends on a fine degree of mutual trust and mutual cooperation. The oars all have to enter the water at precisely the same moment. They have to be held at the same angle. The oars have to be pulled with the same amount of force. The crew really has to become one, melded together.
How big a deal was crew as a sport in the U.S. in the late 20s, 30s?
We forget. Crew was, in fact, enormously popular in the 20s and 30s. Hundreds of thousands of people would turn out for a regatta. Oarsmen were sometimes featured on the cover of Saturday Evening Post and other major magazines. And so becoming an oarsman was a big deal.
But what we see, though, through the prism of crew is, again, this east-west divide. The East Coast was said to own the sport of crew. You've had Princeton and Harvard. How much of an upset was it that the University of Washington began winning, beating these Ivy League schools with this ragtag team of what people, you know, people all assumed they were lumberjacks?
Right. It was a big deal. It was not a terrible surprise to the people from the West, I think, but it was a terrible surprise to the people from the East. These kids from the West coming in and suddenly beating schools that had rowing programs for decades and decades. Nobody at the University of Washington had ever held an oar in his hand before he turned up at the crew house. Many of the kids rowing for the Eastern universities had rowed at least since high school age.
Well, and there was a little bit of dirty business because they win the Olympic trials, and suddenly the Rowing Association says to them, well, you know, you have to pay your way.
Right. What happened was a number of the sports writers from Seattle, within an hour of that, began making phone calls back to Seattle, and phones started ringing off the hook all over Seattle all that night.
Suddenly we're in Boys in the Boat, the musical on Broadway.
Exactly.
Because people are running around collecting pennies.
Exactly. By the next morning, there were people on the street corners with cups collecting pennies and nickels and quarters. They sold little paper tags for a quarter apiece to raise funds to send the crew to Berlin. And within 2 days, they had amassed $5,000, which during the Depression was an extraordinary amount of money. And the boys from Washington were good to go.
Okay, and we'll hear what happened when they got to Berlin. That's Daniel James Brown. His book is The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. In it, we learn about working with wood. We meet legendary boat builder George Pocock, who built all the early sculls and teaches these young men about the swing of the crew. That's that transcendent moment when they work as one. We'll have lots more after the break.
And we'll be back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from GEICO, offering a variety of insurance products, including auto, renters, boat, and motorcycle. More at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO.
It's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. If you're just joining us, we're having an Independence Day conversation about a slice of American history many of us weren't familiar with, the Olympic gold medal win by the University of Washington nine-man crew team at the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. Daniel James Brown has written a goosebump-inducing book about the American farm boys and lumberjacks who made up the team, the evolving post-Depression Northwest that produced them, and the Nazis they challenged in Berlin. The Olympics was Hitler's pre-war chance to whitewash his true agenda. His friend, Leni Riefenstahl, then airbrushed the games further in her propaganda film, Olympia. Daniel, pick up the story there, because for your book, you researched the history of Seattle, of boat building, but also of the Berlin Olympics. Your thoughts?
I was stunned at the extent to which they transformed Berlin for the sake of appearances. So they swept all the homeless people from the streets. They imprisoned all the gypsies, took them off out of their homes in the middle of the night and sent them off to concentration camps from which they never returned. They really transformed it into sort of a movie set for this fantasy version of the Third Reich that they created.
Well, and onto this stage comes the nine boys from the University of Washington, gawking at everything they're seeing.
Yeah.
I mean, they're out of the country for the first time. We know who wins.
Right.
But yet, as you tell this story, we don't think they're going to win. How high were these stakes in this race?
The stakes were enormously high. I mean, they were representing the United States of America. And when you look back at it in the historical context, they were really representing a set of values that we still cherish today, opposed to a set of values that we, I think, universally despise. It's hard not to see it literally as a conflict between good and evil. The American crew, these guys were, I've come to know each of them, even though most of them had passed away by the time I started, by talking to their families. And these were nine very nice young men, open-hearted, eager, pleasant young men. And they came up against the cynicism of the Nazi regime. That's part of what makes that gold medal race so compelling. It also just happened to be one heck of a race.
Unbelievable.
The Americans got off to a terrible start. They and the British were assigned the two outermost lanes, which meant they had to row into the face of a stiff headwind. The German and Italian boats, the two fascist states, were assigned the two innermost lanes, which were very much protected. So they started off with terrible handicaps. They missed the starting signal, so they
got off.
Nobody
could hear it.
No, they couldn't hear it. The wind carried it away. Plus, the starting signal was in French, and it's not entirely clear that any of them understood it. Their stroke oar, the fellow who sets the rhythm of the boat, the most critical oar in the boat, Don Hume, had been sick in bed for days leading up to the race, and they literally got him out of bed, put him in the boat, and asked him to row.
Yeah. But they had another weapon, the coxswain.
They had Bobby Mock.
Small but smart.
Yeah, and pugnacious. He was a real character. He was 5'7", which is how tall I am, so I identify a lot with Bobby Mock. And like any coxswain, he had the task of ordering around a lot of men who were much bigger than him. But he was very, very good at it. He commanded everybody's respect.
And in this race, he scared even the coaches, the University of Washington coaches. He held back so long.
He did. And he had a habit of doing this. He had a habit of terrifying the coaches. Washington liked to row from behind, but Bobby Mock would sometimes hold the boat as much as four lengths behind, an unreasonable distance from the leaders, and then wear down the other crews by just sitting in place and then turn it on at the end.
No.
And he kept getting away with it.
So Bobby Mock, with his megaphone on his mouth, is guiding these eight rowers in front of him, holding them back, and we're holding our breath. How can they possibly win? For a time, they can't even hear anything because of the Heil, because
right.
of the Nazis who
yes.
are cheering on the Germans.
As they come into the last couple hundred meters of the race, the Americans, the way they were positioned, rode right in under the stands where a good part of the 70,000 German fans were seated, or were actually were on their feet, cheering Deutschland, Deutschland, Deutschland. And so the roar of this chant overwhelmed them, and the other boys in the boat couldn't even hear Bobby Mock at that point. And so they're rowing in this sea of sound and just rowing on sheer guts at that point.
Yeah. They win.
Right under Hitler's nose, they win by 0.6 seconds. Yeah.
Quite something. But they kind of went back to, you know, they went to the University of Washington, so they became engineers. They
right.
became part of Boeing. They
yep.
they lived the lives that many of their parents couldn't have imagined
yes.
because of the poverty of the Depression.
Yes.
But never the accolades.
No, there was never, for one thing, they all arrived home in dribs and drabs, so there was never a grand parade or anything like that in Seattle. As they got home that summer, they did what they had always done. They immediately began looking for jobs in order to make it through another year of university at UW.
Yeah. What are they, even when they were very old men, what did they tell you about what that was like when they were on the boat and everything was perfect?
You know, it was an experience that none of them ever forgot. And the thing that really impressed me was it must have been almost like the kind of experience men in combat have, because it bonded them together. And for the rest of their lives, until they were very old men, until the last two of them died, they were almost inseparable. Every year they rode, every 10 years rather, they rode an anniversary race on Lake Washington in front of news cameras. Their families became like one family. When there were only two of them left, Joe Rance and Roger Morris, they were both very old men at this point. Joe and Roger would get on the phone and sometimes sit for an hour or 2 hours and say almost nothing to each other. They just needed to be together, remembering that perfect thing that they had once been.
What are you hearing from people in Seattle and in Washington State?
We had a wonderful evening the other night in a bookstore we had in Seattle to launch the book. Part of what was gratifying for me is that probably 100 of those people were relatives of these nine boys, descendants or whatever of these nine boys. And they are so excited to have this story finally be told, because they, all nine of these families, have nurtured this story for 75 years now, hoping it would somehow get told.
Mm.
And so they are very, very excited about the book.
Well, they should be. The book is The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans in Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. Just a terrific read. Daniel James Brown, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And again, from Leni Riefenstahl's Olympia, the brief reference to that historic race for gold at the 1936 Olympics.
Lethal, lethal! Zu spät, zu spät! Amerika hat gesiegt! Erster, Amerika. Zweiter, Italien. Dritter, Deutschland.
Or as he says, Germany took the bronze, the Italians silver, and the University of Washington boys won the gold in eight-oar crew. If you go to UW, you can see the winning boat, the Husky Clipper, hanging at the Shell House.
And still ahead today, the latest frontier for privacy concerns, our DNA. Who has access to it, and what can they do with it? That story coming up, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the DeMora McKim School of Business at Northeastern University. Experiential learning, entrepreneurship, industry collaboration. DeMora-McKim.northeastern.edu. And Diedrichs, with outdoor furniture, dinnerware, and home accessories selected for form, function, and feeling for your home. DIDRIKS.com.